in many people's lives, then there comes a time when it's useful and valuable to think about their identity as a man. And it also seems that right now, our entire society is run into that period, actually, where we're looking collectively at what does it mean to be a man, and how can we be a man in a better way? There's a lot of people demanding that and requiring it, and a lot of confusion about it as well, because of, you know, the massive amount of, like, I get why there's been a lot of deconstruction of bad ideas of masculinity, understand that. And then sometimes we've been throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And so there's suddenly people are finding, like, wow, I have nothing to stand on anymore. And I have no idea. Like, am I a unicorn? Am I a flying spaghetti monster? Am I a man? Like, what does that actually mean? Jordan Peterson has called for a need to rediscover the spirit of the father. Many have been inspired to embark on their own hero's journey to set their life in order. But how do we balance order and chaos to live a life of meaning? What does it actually mean to be surrendered to God? And how do we root ourselves to stable ground as we witness the re-enchantment of reality? At Manifesto, we're engaged on a mission to rediscover and understand manhood, and from this foundation to create a dynamic and thriving community. My name's Paul. Welcome to Manifesto. Daniel, welcome to Manifesto's YouTube channel.
Well, Paul, Mr. Robson, I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you for having me today, sir. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. So we have a shared friend, Cadell Last, that we got in contact through. I've had some good conversations with him. I think you've had even more conversations with him. I think it's been quite formative certainly for him, maybe for you as well, to be
absolutely
hustling with each other and having some really deep, good philosophical ideas and arguments. And you and me, we've been talking a bit back and forth for a couple of weeks now about doing something on Manifesto's channel. I think you have a lot of good thinking. You're coming from a Christian perspective. And so we decided, okay, well, let's try and take this whole question about masculinity and talk about it from a biblical and a very pragmatic perspective at the same time as well. And you brought forward this idea of the neighbor for doing that with. And so I said, well, okay, hey, Daniel, how about before we get started, I just ask you the question, if someone's not a Christian, why should they listen to you? Could you come with an idea about that? And your response was, well, Paul, that's the first slide of what I'm going to be talking about already. So that was great. So I think, Daniel, I'm going to hand over to you. You're going to have the floor. And then afterwards, I'm going to come with all my sharpest and hopefully useful or whatever, or things that I don't understand, at least, or input that I can think of, and we'll have a little bit of discussion based on that, and we'll see where it leads to. So, yeah, over to you.
Excellent, Mr. Robson. Well, thank you for having me today. I will share my screen, and I really appreciate this opportunity. I will say personally that growing up, the question of masculinity, Christianity, and the relation to the question of neighbor was always very interesting to me, because Jesus seems to teach that loving your neighbor is like loving God, and that these commands go together. So that meant that they somehow had to go. But then figuring out how those worked was a journey. And to start, I want to say that for those who are not explicitly Christian, I think it's actually very good to situate thinking or practice within a particular tradition and to take what you want from it. So, for example, I do a lot of creative writing, and there's this rule that we talk about where it's better to talk about a particular family on a particular farm in a particular time than the universal man or a kind of vague general person. And actually, you get to the universal or general applications from a particular better than if you try to ignore particularity. And so I would say for people who say aren't Christian, or maybe they're not even interested in masculinity, I would actually say that working into a particular framework or a particular issue becomes a very useful way by which to think of bigger subjects. And what I will also get into is I think you will find in the Christian conception of masculinity, a very unique blend of making space for the other and loving the other, and yet still having a meaningful understanding of yourself in terms of masculinity that doesn't dilute either. And I think that's what's so important today, as we're increasingly globalized, connected, pluralistic, diverse, that we have to figure out ways how to say beamen in terms that is also embracing the other and embracing the feminine and embracing children. And I think Christianity offers an extremely useful framework for that, that then has applications to a lot of areas. And then for me, leads to a very particular way of thinking about practicing masculinity. Now, so the way, in spite you mentioned the wonderful Dr. Cadell Last, who I adore, we talk all the time about Hegel. I will very generally structure this in terms of an abstract framework of the Christian framework of neighbor and communal ontology, which the wonderful Trey at Telos found introduced to me on a book on that, and I'll get into that later. Then I'm going to talk about the negation, which is going to be the self-forgetting of a man named Timothy Keller. And then this will get into the concretion of the practice, which I will base a lot on the wonderful work of Raymond K. Hessel. Now, these are all some newer terminologies that I have. When I was younger, I thought more in terms of Kierkegaard, the Trinity, and things in Bonhoeffer, but I will get into that. But I find this language is actually more useful. If you don't identify with Christianity, I think the framework is wonderful. And for those also, I just wanted to say, who are more interested in maybe the feminine embodiment, I am a huge fan of Adriana's work. I've listened to her. She's really helped me think about my daughter, and I just really adore her work. So I would suggest that. I actually think that what we'll be talking about today has implications for the family, both sexes, masculinity, but I wanted to note how much I enjoy Adriana's work because I think that's important. So I'm also going to base this on my story, because I think telling a particular story, like I said, in creative writing can actually help people enter into a space and to see bigger picture. Masculinity never felt like something I could ignore. So I had to figure out a good way to approach it. It didn't feel like something I could just will away or instantly identify with. It felt like something I had to train, embody, and the like. It wasn't just given. On the first video on the core playlist, the individual made a difference between masculinity and maleness. Like, I really like that. Like, everyone is masculine, but you're not necessarily a male. I actually thought about redoing the presentation and incorporating that. I really like that. But I had an intuition of that. Problematically, I felt though, however I define masculinity was kind of arbitrary, right? Like, oh, I'm good at athletics, or, oh, I'm able to take care of people or different things. Well, it always kind of felt arbitrary, or I was just deciding for myself what was a man. And so it could be deconstructed. Derrida, who I was thinking about, talks about the endless deference, right? Where the word cat is never the thing, it always defers away. Where I kind of experienced that, where it was like, well, what is masculinity? And it always kind of deferred away. And so what was the ground upon which I could base it? This is where the neighbor, according to the Gospel of Luke, was a big deal for me, because it created a ground, which is going to get us into the story of the Good Samaritan. And critically, the neighbor is not merely someone who lives next door, but someone good who challenges you. And this was a very important changing. And also, as we'll get into, there's a big difference between being neighborly and loving the neighbor. Now, you have to do both, but this distinction has been lost. All right, now, the first thing I want to talk about is the structure of developing grace in the Bible, because I think if you don't get this, it's you can miss the Good Samaritan story, where Jesus says, the guy asks, who's my neighbor? And he tells the story of the Good Samaritan. So in the Torah, if someone takes out your eye, don't kill them, just take out their eye. If they take your tooth, don't kill them, just take out their tooth. There's actually grace there. There's mercy in it. Now, once you get to Jesus, he's like, turn the other cheek. So you have a logic of grace that's developing and getting more challenging also. There's a higher standard. So it's not merely arbitrary rules. There's a logic of a development that is occurring. So likewise, in Deuteronomy, you have a bill of divorce. If you want to get a divorce, just do the bill. And then you get up to Jesus and he's like, not so easy. You can't divorce freely. So there's a developing grace. You have to marry. You can't just marry anyone or whatever. And then it moves up to Jesus and there's a higher standard. And then in Exodus, we'll talk about has hatred mainly an act, but then you get to Jesus and hatred in murder, frankly, is a heart disposition. So you have a development of grace. So a really important way to think about the movement from the Torah to the gospel is a development of grace. And this isn't because, say, the gospel is superior to the Torah. It's a historic development, which would be Hegelian, a necessary process until Jesus is going to talk about with marriage, your hearts were hard. That's why we had to do the command that Moses gave you about the bill of divorce. You weren't ready for for the standard. So there's this movement of grace to where the heart is developed and ready to go. And also Jesus puts here the notion that the development of grace is in line with an original intention. You know, this is how it was intended originally, but your hearts were hard and you had to go through time till you could get to the place where you were ready. So this is where we're going to get into the question of the neighbor and see the development and transformation of what neighbor means. In Leviticus, the neighbor is mostly defined in terms of your people, okay? So your neighbor is someone more like you. And I think this is naturally how we come to feel about neighbors. So the person living next door, they tend to have similar ideologies. They tend to think similarly then. They're among our people. Well, then we get to Mark, and there's got kind of development. So Jesus, the first thing Jesus is going to do in Mark is he's going to combine together, love the Lord your God with all your heart and love your neighbor as yourself. And so those things come together in a very interesting way. And the guy he's speaking to replies, he's like, you're right, that's more important than offering and sacrifices. That's also a big deal, because in the majority of the Torah, the expression of your love of God or your commitment was sacrifice. And now it's moving to something about love that has something to do with loving your neighbor. Ah, all right. Well, this is where we get to Luke. So this is the Good Samaritan story. And someone comes along and he's like, hey, Jesus, how do I inherit eternal life? And Jesus is like, well, what have you read? And they're like, okay, well, love your Lord with all your heart and with all your soul and love your neighbor as yourself. This is what's interesting. Notice this in the story. Jesus says, do this and you will live, as if it's one command, right? They kind of like, he says, do this, not do these. There's a kind of making of the plural into the singular. So you see Mark. But here's the next step. This is where the story gets fun. The guy's like, well, who's my neighbor? You know, who's that? And then, you know, in reply, Jesus said, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he tells the story of the Good Samaritan. Now, this is fascinating, because they don't ask the guy after the story of the Good Samaritan, you know, which of these do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robber? Note how the robbed man isn't an option. And he says, the one who had mercy on him. And he said, okay, go and do likewise. Well, this is very interesting, because what he's actually suggesting is the Good Samaritan is the neighbor. Well, helping the robbed man is neighborly. So a lot of times we read the story and think that it's the person who's been robbed and on the side of the road who is the neighbor. And, you know, loving your neighbor is taking care of this individual. Jesus has actually blurred the line. The neighbor is the Good Samaritan. And being neighborly is taking care of the person on the side of the road, but you're to love the neighbor. Well, this is really fascinating. So the other thing is it uses ambiguity to refer to both at the same time. You'll notice as you go through these parables, there's a lot of layers that are going on. So it uses that ambiguity. And also Jesus is the Good Samaritan as well. So we're supposed to love our neighbor, love the Good Samaritan, love Jesus. Well, this is actually kind of scandalous because Israelis and Samaritans were not on good terms. They did not like one another. We even see in John 4:9, when the Samaritan woman said, you know, you're a Jew, I'm a Samaritan, we don't get along, you know, after the captivity of Babylon, they're not friends. So Jesus is saying you're supposed to love the Good Samaritan, which is challenging and hard because you're not necessarily friendly with them or they're very, very other. Basically, I think sometimes it can be good for us moderns to think of the Good Samaritan almost for Christians like the good atheist, or for the conservative to think of it as the good liberal, or the liberal to think of the good conservative. It's very difficult. It's not necessarily someone who you jive with. And the reason this is important too, I'll also note, is we need to see that it is the Good Samaritan. Jesus is not just saying any Samaritan, suggesting that there is some room to avoid abuse, manipulation and things like that. And the other thing I'll say is that Jesus has drawn a very interesting connection between loving your neighbor and being neighborly. And there's a wonderful book on this that I love by James K. Smith, where he talks about you are what you love, and what we love is what we tend to become and become like. So we have to love our neighbor in order to become neighborly. But what's so interesting is that Jesus has positioned the Samaritan as the neighbor. And critically, the Good Samaritan isn't just ill and weak, but good, capable, and challenging because they are different. He's able to pay for the robbed man to be taken care of. He's able to take him to the hotel, right? He is a capable individual. He is not someone that just needs to be saved, and yet we are called to love him. If we are neighborly, we will take care of the hurt and sick, but that comes with being able to love a Good Samaritan. And this makes me think of the first things first principle of C.S. Lewis, where he says, if you put first things first, you get second things also. But if you put second things first, you can lose both. And you see, the reason why for me this was a big deal as I started reading The Good Samaritan this way is because to think about masculinity purely in terms of, say, taking care of someone who was robbed on the side of the road or sick or in need didn't seem to make a lot of room for what seemed to be like the challenges of masculinity, right? Like wrestling, like being capable, like being able to carry yourself in a room. But if you're talking about loving someone like a Good Samaritan who is other, who is difficult and challenging, suddenly the command to love your neighbor had something to do with masculinity and being capable of carrying yourself in a certain way. There seems to be, like I said, there's a profound awareness in Luke that if we cannot love those who challenge us because they are other, then our neighborliness will just end up in service of our people, our ideology, and other things which make us comfortable. And that would be going back to Leviticus, right? Where your neighbor is just among your people. And so I think we see this today. You know, one of the things I think we see a lot of being neighborly today that then actually just creates in people separating, people going into areas that are comfortable, say doing things they enjoy together, because we associate being neighborly with just being kind. Right? Whereas what you actually see in the story of the Good Samaritan is that being kind requires also the ability of facing and relating to people that challenge you, and that actually you may even associate with being an enemy or from the other side. And that starts to sound like a little bit of some masculine values. So this was a big deal to me. To be a good neighbor requires facing the challenge of the other and seeing good in him and her. And as you know, from our beloved Dr. Lass, there's a lot of talk of the necessity of the other and identifying with the other. And so all of this started to go, oh, okay, I can see how masculinity and loving God, loving neighbor start to go together because there's a challenge. And also Jesus is very challenging. He calls us to do very difficult things. So there's a challenge and, you know, In the tradition that he's in, they identified him with other and ultimately crucified him, right? So they did not love their neighbor. So the main point of this is neighbors challenge us, which I think you can also bring in Nietzsche's Zarathustra on friends, because friends challenge you in Zarathustra, right? They don't just let you be comfortable. That would make you a last man. There is also good reason not to love our neighbor. I mean, they're Samaritans, right? They're the other side. They're not necessarily good people. Also, the other is that we are to be a gift and to gift. There is a double-sidedness here. And we cannot divide loving and the challenge of otherness, neighbor and neighborly. I think a lot of the problem that's happened today is we've actually separated being neighborly from loving our neighbor. And that's where then being neighborly just results in separation and trouble. And here's the other big point. The greatest commandments, you know, loving God and loving the neighbor, has a looking outward to it. You're looking outside yourself. And on this last point, this going to get into the issue of self-relating negativity. And I wanted to bring that up because Trey is outstanding and Trey has talked about this. We often define masculinity in terms of self-relating negativity without realizing it. We ask ourselves, what do I think it is to be a man? What do I think adds value? Well, what are you doing? You're relating to yourself, right? And you're thinking about your terms of what is masculine. The funny thing is we also tend to naturally avoid challenge. So this can be a problem because then we tend to define masculinity to ourselves in ways that make us comfortable. And what Trey's going to talk about on Telesbound that's so good is the Zizekian subject is the abyss of hell, where in self-relate, that's actually how you kind of go into a hell when you start relating to yourself. And he also has a great one on skepticism with Pavel that also will talk into that. So also when I thought about masculinity as just relating it to myself, then I always could deconstruct it in that way, right? Because I'd always relate it to my ideas of what was masculinity, and it could always always deconstruct. And Dr. Cadell Last is very good at this. I also like to talk about the absolute choice of opening ourselves up to the other. So please also note, though, that this very negativity that we're talking about, without it, we wouldn't have an opening for the other, right? Like the very fact that we are incomplete in ourselves means there is a opening that if we try to relate to, we just devour ourselves. But if we instead see it as an opening to others, well, then we can start entering into masculinity must define itself in a communal ontology, in a relationship with other people. Otherwise, it's going to just devour itself. Now, when I was younger, I didn't have the term communal ontology because Trey introduced me to that. I had the term of Trinitarian ontology. And this would basically say that we have to identify ourselves in terms of others. And also, it seemed to me that you couldn't be like Christ unless you somehow were like the Trinity, which, of course, then what is the Trinity? Well, it's fundamentally a community. And without that community, you end up deconstructed or devouring yourself. So that would mean masculinity must fit within a framework of the notion that loving a challenging other is loving God, because now we're tying it to the Good Samaritan, right? And if you don't, you're going to end up in a self-relating negativity. And then you just eat yourself. And I see that's what we see happening. People defining masculinity outside of a community, outside of a neighbor, or just being neighborly, which then makes them think of themselves as a savior, makes them relate to themselves, and they just devour themselves in the way that Trey talks about. And this is where the neighbor plays a major role, because again, masculinity without the neighbor falls into self-relating negativity and can pathologically deconstruct itself. And that's what I was saying. Whenever I tried to define it to myself, I would just be like, well, what is it? And it seems arbitrary. Well, the neighbor isn't, again, I just want to emphasize, the neighbor isn't just someone we serve in need of us. It's also someone we serve in challenge. We serve in the context of a challenge. We must add value, but we also must avoid savior mentalities. And what's so brilliant about that story in Luke is that it's doing both. And then it defines the neighbor that we are to love in terms of the Samaritan, not just the person on the side of the road. So there's a challenge here. I will also note that the persons of the Trinity serve one another, but not from like a place of neediness. They need one another to be themselves, but it's also a lost in the love and wonder of one another, right? That they're totally open. And I will also say that results in the persons of the Trinity not thinking of themselves, but thinking of the other. There's a kind of self-forgetfulness. That's going to be an important term that seems to define the community of really paying attention to the other. And so again, I think by not getting this, you can accidentally emphasize being neighborly at the expense of loving our neighbor. And Jesus suggests that we have to do both, or we'll actually lose both. We could lose both. And that was important for me. Now, masculinity thus must be toward the other and in community, in its very becoming, to avoid the hell of self-relating negativity. And so kind of a false masculinity avoids the challenge of otherness and becomes misshapen and disordered as a result. So masculinity without challenging others, like others that challenge you, actually ends up deconstructing itself. Now, and thus masculinity devours and self-devours, where masculinity isn't a gift for others and trained. Because now we're going to play on the term gift as we start moving toward what this means. For me, I like to think of masculinity as an art form you offer, not just an identity you are. So it's a gift, right? It's something that you give people. And in fact, if you think of it just as an identity, as something you are, then you end up in that self-relating negativity where you just devour yourself and, you know, you just eat yourself. Yes, the second is included in the first, obviously. If you're giving masculinity as a gift, there's a sense in which you are masculine. But it's also an order principle. By primarily thinking it of a gift, then the identity comes second to the offering, as opposed to you saying, oh, look at me, I'm masculine. Oh, look at me, I'm a man. And then it becomes a self-relating negativity. I also like thinking of it as an art. And I also like the individual that was talking about the relation of the art and masculinity on the playlist. I thought that was very good because art used to mean skill, not just something you hung on the wall, but it was a skill that was deeper than merely something practical. It also had like a fuller vision of the world that was part of it in practice, in the concrete. And Jonathan Pagio will also talk about that change of how we think about art now as something we hang on a wall as opposed to something we do and that we are. And I think that's been, that's an important shift that has occurred. And like I said, I think it could be a danger can be talking about masculinity as a kind of trophy, you know, something that we are and that we get celebrated for. But again, this has the danger of a self-relating negativity. But if we think of it as a gift, something that you're skilled in and something you offer, that can help. Critically, masculinity is earned through loving the neighbor. And so this, because it's challenging, it's precisely in loving the neighbor that one develops that ability of the masculine in serving the neighbor, because that is how you love God and how you love the neighbor as yourself. You know, you can't get masculinity if you're not going to be following the first command that Jesus puts out, right? So there's something about the relation of the neighbor that creates the opportunity of this communal ontology that then also creates a useful ground for the masculine and what exactly it means. Again, a gift is an offering, an ability. And I really stress the Good Samaritan is clearly rich. He's clearly has money. He clearly has a plan. He is a capable individual. And so what does it mean to love a challenging, capable individual? What does it mean to relate to them? Some questions to ask, and I love to cut up to this in the question and answer. So if your neighbor needed help cutting down a tree, could you actually help him cut down the tree? If they were interested in economics, could you tell them something that wasn't found on the 27 News? If they're going through an emotionally difficult situation, could you offer supporting guidance? Can you tell a joke during a party? Can you entertain kids with a story on the fly? These are some of the questions you start asking, because these are challenges, right? It is not easy to cut down a tree. It is not easy to have something that is valuable to say. But if you think about loving your neighbor in terms of there being a kind of challenge you have to rise up to, well, then going over and seeing your neighbor is not merely having fun together. It's a context of value in being there for them. You know, obviously between the Jews, between Israel and the Samaritans, there's more of a national, you know, it's more of a conflict, like straight up war and fighting and different things like that. But many of us with our neighbors are not going to necessarily find someone who's trying to get into a fight to the death with us, but we still have to think in terms of challenge and how we can rise to that challenge, which is going to, and to be able to do those things, you need mastery and you have to work, right? You have to have to make a valuable gift. You have to develop the gift to give the gift. So the word of gift goes together in both ways. But here's where this is what to me became very important. We need a test to determine if we add value and have stable reason to think that we do. And the neighbor is the test. You know, if you're like, I think I have masculinity, but you just tell yourself that, well, there's no ground for it, right? You're just telling yourself that. But if you literally have to go next door and somehow add value to their life, there's a test that isn't about you and your identity. It is about them and what you do for them. And that becomes the basis of your identity. And Jesus seems to be suggesting this in the act of loving the neighbor and then also being neighborly for the person in need. But here's where, for me, I found a problem. And this is where I got stuck for a long time. How can we tell, though, if our masculinity is a gift and something that offers values to others? And doesn't asking that force us into a self-relating negativity, right? Like once you go, oh, I think being able to cut down a tree adds value. Well, based on what? How do you know? Aren't you just relating that to your own idea, right? So this became kind of a problem. I was like, oh, you know, it's also not easy to tell what adds value, right? You know, maybe I think economics and knowing about economics adds value, but my neighbor might not think that, right? So this is hard because then I have to really know my neighbor in order to know if I'm adding value or not. And remember, they're challenging. Crap. So I have to face a challenge to know what their values are. And then I have to add that value. Oh man, this is, you know, the bar is kind of going up, right? And then there's always the problem that if you decide something is a value, what is your ground for thinking that's not just you thinking it as opposed to being something that's there for your neighbor, right? And it felt very problematic to think of this way, you know. And it also became clear to me, something that always interests me with Jesus is how like blessings just seem to like flow out of him, right? Like he just goes to the gate and there's a blind man who heals, or there's a woman that's in need. He doesn't like intentionally say, I'm going to go save some people today. It's just like wherever he goes, he has wisdom to give. He has blessings. They flow out of them more than kind of an intentional bestowing mindset, right? Like he's not like, oh, I'm going to do things. He's not thinking about himself very much, right? It just flows out of him. So that always interested me with Jesus. And how does he do that? This is when I came across something very, very important that kind of transformed how I carried myself in the world. And that is The Freedom of Self-Forgetfulness by Timothy Keller. This book really impacted me, and it had a big impact on how I thought about masculinity as something that flows out of us as opposed to something we bestow, something that can be a gift that is just part of the way we carry ourselves in the world, as opposed to something going, I'm going to go add value to my neighbor. I'm going to go be a savior today, which can fall into the problems of self-relating negativity. The book is going to be about the problem of telling the difference between, say, selfishness and selflessness, right? Because there actually seems to be a ditch on either side of the road. Like there's the egotistical thinking about yourself all the time, but then there's a kind of self-degradation where you're constantly degrading yourself and saying, oh, I'm not worthy, or no, I can't help. And there's like a humility that's actually toxic. Well, how do you navigate that, right? Like, how do you think of overly focusing on something and then deconstructing something? Because that seems to be the problem that masculinity falls into, right? There can be this trophy masculinity that you're always thinking to hold over people or to prove yourself in a kind of prideful way. But then there's this deconstruction of masculinity where you're always talking about how bad it is and you're destroying it. And both of those seem like a ditch on either side of the road. So how do you find the middle? And this applies to selfish and selflessness as well. Like, how do you tell the difference between pride and humility? Well, what Timothy Keller talks about, and he references C.S. Lewis a lot, is that he talks about self-forgetfulness. And what he means is like a truly humble person is not telling you how humble they are at the time, because that would actually be kind of obsessed with themselves. Like, oh, I'm actually nothing. Oh, I'm not very good at anything. Oh, I can't cut down trees. Oh, I can't talk about economics. That's actually kind of self-obsessed, right? And what he talks about is the essence of gospel humility is not thinking more of yourself, but thinking of yourself less. You are so lost in the other person, and you being there for them that you're not thinking about yourself. You forget yourself in your observation and observing of them. I love how he talks about it like a toe. Like, you don't really look at your toe. There's something kind of deformed about looking at your toe, right? You just use it, right? You just use your toe. It's just there. It's just there. And in fact, if you weren't using it, that would be an indication that it was broken or that there was something wrong. So it's just something you use. And for me, I started to think about masculine forgetfulness in a sense of masculinity. When you're fully masculine and you're actually mastered it to a kind of excess. And I really like Mr. Ebert's language of the difference between excess and absence. And what he talks about is that when you have, like, imagine you have a bug on a windshield and it spreads until the goo covers the whole windshield. It's going to look like nothing. It's a disgusting image, but it gets the point. Like, it looks like nothing, but it's a nothing, kind of an apathetic nothing that comes from an excess, as opposed to a deconstruction where there's nothing there. And so for me, this opened the door to thinking about a state where masculinity was not a burden on me, where I was always thinking about it, or how can I add value to other people and so on and so forth. But it became something you forgot about because it worked for you. You were doing it. You were participating in it. And it just flowed out of you, like you seem to see in Jesus, where he's just able to walk into places and it flows out of him. And the idea of masculine forgetfulness then was very helpful. And it was also very liberating to me. And it also, I connected it with the arts. Like, great writers don't think about writing, they just do it. Like, great dancers don't think about the next step, they just do it. They've so practiced it to a point where it just flows out of them, which also makes me think of Nietzsche's centipede. There's a story of a centipede, like an ant comes along and says, how do you use all those legs? And the centipede freezes up because it can't answer it. Like, it was able to do it until it thought about it. And that's how I often masculinity was for me. Like, I would think about what is masculinity, and then it would kind of freeze up. And then this concept of like, oh, wait a minute. How do we get to a place where masculinity is so part of ourselves that it just flows out of us? And that was where I was very freeing to find Mr. Keller's work. And like I said, it's something I wanted to thought about. And the other thing that's beautiful about that is when masculinity becomes something that flows out of you, it is not something that you're constantly asserting to other people that you have or thinking about yourself, which can hurt relationships, become a kind of trophy and things like that. And that would get into where it's flowing out of. And that's also how we avoid the savior mentality. That can be very dangerous, where we'll end up being neighborly, but not necessarily in the same way that the good that we're supposed to from the story of the Good Samaritan. And I think also this speaks to the Trinity, because the Trinity forgets itself in one another. The persons of Jesus is lost in the Father. The Father is focused on the Son and the Holy Spirit. There's a the persons of the Trinity in that communal ontology are actually flowing into one another. And so I think it overlays with that. So this was a big deal for me. This was very helpful. This was very liberating and had a big impact. Then I finally kind of had a standard for practice and how to think about being masculine and carrying myself. And this was a big deal. And it's the neighbor that becomes the challenge to the place of becoming masculine forgetful. Because it is when you encounter the neighbor that you find out if you actually have become someone who masculinity can just flow out of, as opposed to someone that you think about. And I'll explain what I mean by that. I decided that masculine forgetfulness was when masculinity was a gift, where you had moved it to a place where it had become a gift, which then situated it in a communal ontology. And that to do all of that was then to love your neighbor in the way that it described in Luke. Those things came together for me. Because if you worked masculinity to the place where it was a gift, as in a skill, that means you could then gift it to other people in a community. And that would then be to meet the challenge of the neighbor that we see in the Good Samaritan. So those things started to come together to me, but there was still kind of a problem. It had to forget itself. You know, I have to forget itself, or it ends up in a self-relating negativity. But here's where it got interesting for me. I associated the self-forgetfulness with like a doorknob that worked. Heidegger will talk about a doorknob that you notice being one that's broke, right? So the very fact that you don't notice it and it's invisible is actually a sign that it works, right? So you want to work. So your masculinity has to work. It has to be strong. It has to be capable. And so it has to be something you use and you don't think about. Like your masculinity has to be something you flow out of and you don't think about it. Otherwise, it becomes like a broken doorknob that then becomes visible as opposed to invisible and something you flow with. So the trick is using the doorknob without noticing it. Well, what the heck? How do you use something without noticing it? And this is this for me, then following Jesus, who didn't think about himself, I thought that the test for masculine forgetfulness was what happened when I faced my challenging neighbor. Like when I put myself in the context of my neighbor, then I would find out if I was actually a doorknob that worked as opposed to break. If, you know, you can keep a doorknob from breaking by not using it, right? Yeah, you wouldn't notice it then, but it would be pretty useless, right? And I think kind of often we've come today to think about masculinity as something we can keep from breaking by not using it, by not putting it in a context where it could be challenged. Well, then it's meaningless, right? So by the challenging neighbor becomes the place where you find out if you've actually worked masculinity to a place where it is mastered, where it is a gift, where it is something that can flow out of you. So then I decided that masculine forgetfulness is tested in loving our neighbor. Like you find out if you've actually mastered masculinity in the act of loving your neighbor as following Luke, the Gospel of Luke. But here we go. What does it mean to love your Good Samaritan? You know, your challenging neighbor. What does that mean? Well, right or wrong, I felt that it was to add value. I somehow had to add value to my neighbor, right? Okay, but how do you add value without thinking about it? And what does it mean to add value anyway? These were all the questions that started to come into my head. And how do you add value while maintaining masculine or self-forgetfulness? And I'll note that those go together, because if you're thinking about yourself, that also leads into masculinity. So it's like, how do you even do that? What does that even mean? I decided it was being ready for what life threw at me, which had to be done or shown, not talked about. You can't just talk about it. You actually have to do it. And it kind of reminds me too, like if you ask people, what is art? It's really hard to answer that. But if you see art, it's easy to say, what is art, right? In the same way, like being masculine can be sometimes hard to describe, but when you see it, you know it, right? Because it's an art form. It's like, oh, there it is. It's right there. So I associated with it being ready for what life threw at me. This is what I found. When I went next door to my neighbors and I say couldn't cut down the tree, or they asked me to help with the wash machine, I didn't know how to do it. That's when I thought about myself as a man. That's when the doorknob broke. And that's actually when I was in my worst behavior. Like that's when I could be like a jerk, right? It was actually when I found myself unable to do something, like a challenge that was presented. That's when I reflected on myself. Instead of then self-forgetful, it was like self-remembering. And right in that very act, I think you see the truth of the self-relating negativity and how that is in fact the door to hell, and how it leads you to hell, just like Trey leads to, because you reflect on yourself and you become visible as yourself because you're incapable of doing something. You can't help your neighbor. You're not able to be there, or you can't face the challenge of their difference. Then you reflect on yourself. And that's when I self-remembered and was more prone to act poorly, insecurely, and things like that. So to speak Hegelian very quickly, my goal then became to negate thinking about masculinity through practices that made it invisible, like Heidegger's doorknob. So this is the Hegelian move, right? So I want to engage in practices where I don't self-remember. I just am the masculine. It just flows out of me like Jesus, where he's just able to improv and answer things. But we can't be prepared for everything, right? And that might frankly make us crazy. Are we going to be like a doomsday prepper or something like that? True, but the very fact you can't be prepared for everything can actually generate some useful humility. And then we can also make a distinction between wise preparation and fear-based preparation. Now that requires a different an entire different presentation. I actually think this topic is really important, but I think the humility part is good. But that's fine. But by what standard do we determine like if we're prepared or not? And you know, what is a way to put it as we approach the end here, what is the best practice to increase the probability that I maintain self-masculine forgetfulness while loving and adding value to my challenging neighbor? What is the way of life that would actually increase the probability that I'm able to maintain that blessing state as I go? Well, this is the unarmored test. And this had a big impact on how I lived and how I thought about things and what I literally how I spent my time and what I thought about. Very big, big deal. So we cannot do something. We lack a gift. When we cannot do something, we lack a gift. We cannot gift masculinity. And that makes us think about masculinity. We thus lose self-forgetfulness and we enter into self-relation. The way I thought about it, Kierkegaard has this part where he makes this point where he's like, hey, one of the reasons the world is in trouble is because people can't be alone in a room for like 3 minutes, like without like looking at their phone, without distracting themselves. And they're always running from themselves. And I was like, that's true. And it's like, am I able to actually say sit in a room, or could I actually talk with someone and actually talk with them and be present as opposed to checking my phone? Another way to put this is Raymond K. Hassel in his wonderful book, Notes from the Pod, will note how in the story of Prometheus and his brother hands all the animals like claws and fur, and he gets to humans and goes, oh shoot, I forgot to give you all something. I don't have anything. So they're like naked. And it's actually because of that very nakedness and vulnerability that humans then come together and are able to make society. Whereas the animals who have, say, claws and furs or different things, precisely because they have those, don't actually have to come together. So nakedness compels us to the neighbor, but also nakedness or lacking armor is a way that we start to find human strength, and it brings out human strength. So this is what it meant for me. Could I visit my friends without a phone, right? Could I play football without watching it? And what I mean by that is often like if you're watching sports as opposed to playing sports, the entertainment is a kind of armor from facing yourself, right? You're not having to find out if you yourself can play football or if you can do the sports because you're just watching other people do it. Likewise, if you visit someone, you can use your phone as armor to not actually see if you're capable of relating to them or adding value because you're distracted by the phone. It became important to me to be able to go over, and if they ask questions about what do I think about the political situation or economics, to not just talk about the 24/7 news. Did I have my own thoughts? Had I read my own books? Or was I just hiding behind the cultural paradigms or things that people were saying, like kind of the headlines or things like that? You know, could I sit across a table and have nothing but conversation, like just them? Could I actually add value to them with just the conversation? Also, could I fix an appliance without calling someone, right? If I was naked, if I didn't have the ability to call someone to come help. Also, could I help someone navigate a personal situation? Was I capable of doing that with my own resources that I had when I ran into them? Could I give a defense for what I believed right now? Could I tell a story that didn't bore people? And could I defend my family with just my hands? If I could not do these things, can you emotionally connect with people? Could you increase wonder in kids? Could you sit with your wife and be there? Or will you just be on your phone or looking for a distraction? Can you be naked per se? Can you be unarmored? Because that's when you find out if your masculinity has actually been developed, not when you're, say, able to hide behind a phone or hide behind a headline or hide behind your job. It's when you're actually unarmored. That's when you find out what you're capable of. I just want to emphasize, it always amazed me how Jesus seemed to be an improvisational master. Like whatever situation he's in, he has an answer. He's able to help people. And that ability seemed critical to me. But improvisation as such is the ability to address any situation that you find yourself in or that you're thrown into. And you find out if you're able to do that from a place of nakedness, from forcing yourself to play football, not watch football, from talking to someone, not being on your phone. That's when you're there. And that becomes the test. And then that meant, you know, and so what it came in my head to mean is that the more capable we are when we're unarmored, the more we have something to hold back. And thus, the more we can be like Jesus. I think we always have to remember that Jesus is actually incredibly powerful, right? He's like God, right? At any point, he could come down from the cross, right? He could like yell at people. He could defeat anyone. But he's always in a way holding himself back, right? There's, Dante talks about this. I won't get too much into it. But there's a way in which grace always requires God to hold himself back, because otherwise he'd destroy us, right? Because he's so powerful. And so then humility is the holding of strength back, not the absence of strength. Right? And what we see in Jesus, I mean, the man's a carpenter. We always have to remember this. You know how hard it was to be a carpenter back then? I mean, that's extraordinary. And yet he's holding himself back. But the only way you can tell if you have something to hold back is, in fact, what you're able to do when vulnerable, when you're naked, when you're not hiding behind your phone, when you're forced to talk about something and you can't just turn to the headlines. And I also think it's really important that in the Garden of Eden, Adam, which was the name of both the man and the woman before the fall, therefore Trinitarian, they were naked and unaware they were naked, right? So they were self-forgetful while completely unarmored. And I think this is how we were made. And we'll recall what Jesus said about marriage and getting back to the original intention. So what you see in Adam is a self-forgetfulness. They don't know they're naked. They're just focused on the other. They're focused on God, and they're completely unarmored. So there's something about this that is very, very important. Now, again, I'm not saying that it's bad to know how to use a chainsaw or watching a game with someone. No one is saying that. But the issue is that thinking about what am I, when I encounter my neighbor, am I encountering them unarmored or am I encountering them armored? Am I going to my neighbors to watch football or to play football? Am I going to my neighbors to talk about what we saw on TV or to talk about what we think? Are we there to like gossip about what other people are doing? Or are we there to talk about where we are at in our spiritual and emotional lives, right? Are we facing one another? And that's where it becomes very challenging, where the neighbor has a challenge. And the more different the neighbor is, the more challenging that becomes. And the more being able to pass the unarmored test becomes important for being able to rise to that challenge. And so suddenly loving my neighbor became a big challenge, which aligned it with the Good Samaritan. I had to always be able to flow and not break, right? Because, you know, if I go to my neighbors and I'm only able to be there because of my phone, well, if I lose the phone, well, then it comes out that I haven't developed my masculinity, right? Or if there's not a game on the TV, it comes out that I'm not actually able to play football. Like everything comes out. And then you relate to yourself in terms of a man and you do it in terms of self-relating negativity, as opposed to the masculinity be a gift that comes out precisely in the nakedness, the unarmoredness, in the vulnerability. So in conclusive points, passing the unarmored test for me increased the likelihood I maintained masculine forgetfulness as necessary for communal ontology while loving my neighbor. Those all came together. And that was the practical test that I put myself to. So masculine forgetfulness is a result of work, practice, and the like, so that we aren't broke and self-reminded by the challenge of the unexpected or the challenge of the Good Samaritan. Those went together. And of course, only Jesus did it perfectly. And so there's grounds for humility. I am not, you know, if I went over next door right now and my younger nephew wanted to do parkour, I was listening to someone with parkour, I would suck. And I would be reminded of that. I am not the best. I had to fix a washing machine recently and was amazed by the ability my grandfather must have had to do electrical work. So I certainly am not someone who can say that he is always masculine forgetful in terms of a communal ontology. But this framework made me change how I use my time and think about it. Like, was I using a phone or technology to hide? Was I developing skills or thinking that if I visit my neighbor and had to confront my neighbor, I could add value? Was I someone who only defined neighbors as people who were like me, and thus it was easy to like and it wasn't challenging? Was I using my neighbor for entertainment, or was I using them to call me to something higher? Was I only being neighborly? Or was I actually loving my neighbor and being neighborly? Everything changed. And the way that you related to other people became, people were not, Relating to other people was no longer just about feeling good or having a good time. It was about facing a challenge of what it means to be human so that we can actually be there for one another. And that then made the idea of being a neighbor and a good neighbor utterly essential to being to entertaining and manifesting a good form of masculinity, which I aligned with Jesus. And I also believe in closing that all of this actually has implications for relationships, sexuality, family, and the like. But for now, thank you very much. I've enjoyed this. So thank you.
Thank you, Daniel. That's greatly appreciated. And certainly you can feel that you've really thought long and hard and deep for a long time about all of these things. So I really enjoyed and appreciated that. And I've written down a whole lot of stuff here that I want to ask you about. And we've gone long over the time that we're planning to use
I'm so sorry.
Presentation. So what I was thinking we'll do is that we're going to say this is one video here. And so people who are watching don't, so this will become a super long video, but I want to continue this conversation right now. I probably have another half hour I can talk, but we're going to make that into a separate second video, because otherwise it's going to be a really long one as well. So let's say we're stopping the recording now and going over to the next one. And now if you're watching, this is the second video of Paul and Daniel talking. If you missed the first one, then you can see the link down in the description underneath, I guess. And we're going to talk about the presentation that Daniel just did about masculinity, about the good neighbor, the challenging neighbor, and the questions, some of the questions that I have. And what I really liked is where you started off with, you spoke about how this question of masculinity kind of like was making itself apparent to you and needing to go into it. And I think as well, just as the way you talk about like the self-forgetting man or self-forgetting masculinity, like if we spend our whole life thinking about this idea of masculinity, it really becomes like what comes with this danger of just like navel gazing kind of thing. But it seems to me that in many people's lives, then there comes a time when it's useful and valuable to think about their identity as a man. And it also seems that right now, our entire society has run into that period, actually, where we're looking collectively at what does it mean to be a man, and how can we be a man in a better way? There's a lot of people demanding that and requiring it, and a lot of confusion about it as well, because of, you know, the massive amount of, like, I get why there's been a lot of deconstruction of bad ideas of masculinity, understand that. And then sometimes we've been throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And so there's suddenly people are finding like, wow, I have nothing to stand on anymore. And I have no idea, like, am I a unicorn? Am I a flying spaghetti monster? Am I a man? Like, what does that actually mean? That really made sense for me. What is your thoughts about like that time that we're facing right now and the value of us as a society talking about masculinity in a more explicit way?
Well, that's outstanding. And again, the writer who never thinks about writing will not be able to get to the place where writing is something they just do without thinking about it, right? So there has to be an intentional thinking about what is masculinity? What does that mean? In order to think through it and to do it well. Now, it is not necessarily always easy to tell what in a given situation constitutes masculinity. And that's why there has to be the work and the practice and the attempt and the failure and the retrying and the not giving up to determine that thing. But if one does not do that, then it's not possible to get to a place where it becomes forgetful, right? You know, the key is when Keller talks about self-forgetfulness, he's not saying self-degradation or self-ignorance. He's talking about a kind of a confidence in self that trusts in the self in the act of caring about other people, that the self is being used. It has to be being used, but it's not focused on itself. I think the culture, so it's very interesting, like in Christianity, a lot of the mistakes are so close to the truth, but if you're 99% right and you're off by 0.1, it's still infinitely off because God is like, you know, perfect. Like we look at the temptations of Satan in the desert, right? He's not like tempting Jesus to like commit adultery or murder. He's kind of tempting him with like, just turn these rocks to stones. Is that so bad? Or jump in the tower. I'll give you the world. Don't you want to save the world, Jesus? I'm going to give you the world. He's like, yeah, but it's in the wrong way. There's all of those temptations suggest that there's a correct way to do this. And the way you get to something changes the end that you get to. Yeah.
I think people reach a critical junctures in their life a lot of the time. Often when there's a change in role, we have this idea of kind of like, you know, of rich rites of passage or something like that, where we need to step into a new responsibility, you know, becoming a father or, you know, taking a new job as a leader or something like that, where there can be a need for reconsidering our role as a man and how we're doing that and how we're doing it well and being able to be inspired by others. I thought in your presentation, you really had a very great insight, something I've heard before, but hadn't reflected about very much, actually, which is that when we listen to the story of the Good Samaritan, we pretty much always think of like, oh, I'm the Good Samaritan and the robbed man is the neighbor, right? That's the way we always kind of, it just automatically goes that way. We hear that story and we think of that way. And that's explicitly and very clearly not the way it's intended. And I was actually, can you say a little bit more about why you think we always get that wrong? Why is it that we see it? And what does it actually mean that the way I see it is we're the robbed man, we're the man who's leading there, you know, bleeding, dying, suffering. And actually it's the Good Samaritan, the neighbor who comes with Christ as the example, actually, Christ as the Good Samaritan who comes and are we able to love that person? That's actually the radically different idea, which is very difficult actually to accept in a surprising way, I guess, right?
Well, oh no, it's an excellent question. Well, one of the reasons it's important to understand the logic of developing grace is because if Jesus is simply saying that being a good neighbor is helping the person on the side of the road, well, that's just Leviticus. That's just your people, right? But if there's a developing grace logic that's going on, then Jesus is raising the ante a little bit. Also, there's something about the need to know how to read literature. A parable is intentionally ambiguous because it has many layers of paint. And we tend to read it just like a moral truism. And we say, oh, the straight, you know, the clear message is that you're supposed to take care of people on the side of the road. Yes, that is definitely part of it. But the question is, who is your neighbor? And he says, the one who is neighborly. And that is the Good Samaritan. Also, you need to know the historic context of the scandal, basically the scandal of talking about a Good Samaritan to Pharisees and Sadducees. Like I said, it's hard for us to get that because it's become very cute. A Samaritan, oh, the Good Samaritan is a good thing. And we even call organizations the Samaritan, Good Samaritans, right? But for Jews, it would be talking about threats and enemies. And he's saying to love them. And obviously he's a threat to, you know, he's viewed as a threat as Jesus. That's why he's crucified. So he's saying love him. But what he's doing is also, I think it's because of the culture that really emphasizes like neighborliness. Suburbia neighbors are those people you have niceties to. Like you walk outside and you see them getting your mail and say, hey, what's going on, neighbor? And so your neighbor, you're nice to. And so the very historic moment feeds into thinking about neighbor as someone who's got a similar job. They have a similar work schedule because they're your neighbor and they're around you. And so then the idea of the Good Samaritan is challenging. I think it's lost in the reading.
Yeah, I think that actually since I've moved to a very small town, which I know you also live in, my idea of what a neighbor is has shifted very radically away from that, actually. So I think it's actually a kind of a weird, maybe Hollywood idea of what a neighbor is or something like that. Yes. Just wanted to add, you know, so in the story of Christ, I think there's a good perspective in that, you know, as Christ as the Good Samaritan, in that Christ is the God-man, right? So he is this kind of ultimately powerful being that was in this situation now coming to a group of people who were living in complete bondage to the Romans and in many ways, a broken people. There was this tribe of Pharisees who had kind of taken over and had the power in the society. And they were living under this very oppressive system of rules and laws and something like that, right? So it was really a broken system in some ways. And so Christ was coming as the Good Samaritan and saying like, hey, I want to heal you. I have everything that you need. and so for the Pharisees to love Christ, and their response, of course, was to hate Christ as well, right? So this is something about as well, like when someone who we don't recognize, I really like the way you call it, like the other, the challenging other comes to us and has the thing that we need to be healed, then there's a part of us, you know, we actually sometimes need to, we need to be purged of the thing that's making us sick. And that can be a very scary thing for us as well, right? And often that is that challenging other who has that thing. It's almost like going through a death.
No, I think that's beautifully put. if one goes into a library and looks at the commentary of War and Peace, it takes up two shelves. You look at the commentary of like the Prodigal Son, it takes up like entire libraries. Like one of the things that's extraordinary about these parables is all the different layers and operations. So another, for example, if you're supposed to be like Christ and therefore be like the Good Samaritan, you have to be good in a context of being rejected. Because, you know, you're a Samaritan, so in the nation, people don't like you, right? And you have to be good while being other yourself. So you're in the world, but not of it. So you have that layer that's going on. And definitely, the story is suggesting that if you don't love Jesus, because you're supposed to love your neighbor, you're also not going to be neighborly. That's why he combines in the story loving God and loving your neighbor. That's the brilliance of the parable. He's got to tell both of those at the same time. So that's definitely an operation.
Yeah, good. So yeah, I said that. I moved to this town. We have 300 people here.
Nice.
Before I came here, it's quite far out on the countryside. And me and my wife, we were really expecting we're going to be like these very exotic people out here, very different. We've like traveled and explored and done all these kinds of weird and wonderful things living in the big city. And what we found out is like, actually this town is totally, completely packed full of all kinds of very colorful, weird and wonderful personalities. And so I've come to realize like and it's also a town though where we're incredibly blessed that people really want to be a part of each other's lives. And there's so much shared activity and it's something that's kind of hidden and you don't even realize that aspect of being exists. I found when I've been living in a big city my entire life before I came out here. And so what I found is like, there's all these people where we're radically different in our understandings of, and I think there's probably even become more, of course, in recent times as well. But we have this desire, okay, we have to work together. So we're kind of forced to be doing something. And that means that we all have to let go a little bit of the sharp edges of ourselves in order to be able to collaborate with the other ones. We have to learn how to love a little bit more broadly as well, or something like that. And I think especially what Christ was showing here is that maybe the world was going through a shift in some way from being a very tribalized society to, you know, the Roman Empire had really reached its zenith at this point. And so this is where kind of like this globalized society was really becoming far more apparent and relevant. And this is a trend that's just, you know, over the big, you know, arc of human history is just increasing. And so we talk these days about like the glocal society, right? Where in some ways now, you know, we say if the World Cup is happening right now and everyone has an opinion on what's happening in Qatar as far as their labor policies and their marriage policies and, you know, all these other policies and concerns. And so everything is being tied together in a far more complex way as well, right? And how do we manage to create good conversations that are actually, you know, productive and edifying and I'm not just like tearing down the other where, you know, like, you know, Qatar is a very, very alien society for me. And I have all kinds of opinions on what they're doing there. But how do I make sure I'm not actually just becoming a part of the problem when I start shouting up about like, oh, no, Qatar needs to do this and this and this, right? It's like, well, what do I actually know about Qatar and my demands about that? And I hear people like saying like, oh, yeah, well, why don't we just shut down FIFA and we start a new FIFA? And it's like, are you so sure that you would do it better? Like, yeah, FIFA is certainly, FIFA is not perfect at all. I think FIFA is a terrible organization. But like this idea that I would all do it better, it's like this kind of rebellious spirit sometimes isn't equated to a good neighborly approach of masculinity as well, I think, right?
Absolutely. So a few things. First, if there's something about human nature, when you encounter something that's imperfect, that you seek to destroy it, as opposed to reform it and rightly order it. And you were mentioning, like, the problem today is, indeed, there have been problematic forms of masculinity. And what's happening today is there's a response of, therefore, deconstruct it, as opposed to, no, what if we were to create an excess of it to where it's a kind of masculine forgetfulness, which is from a place of mastery, not a place of deconstruction. In a sense, it's a similar goal, right? You're trying to not think about masculinity, but one of them is from a deconstruction, which then is ultimately, I think, pathological and actually creates a ton of trouble, as opposed to, no, what if we were to do it in an idea of an excess so that it actually is something that flows out of us? Now, what has happened on, you mentioned the city and the country, what's very interesting is that busyness in a whole lot of people can actually create an armor from encountering individuals. because, oh, I'm not facing the challenge of my neighbor because my work is my challenge or my job is my challenge. That's what you do. But you see, the problem is that easily fits into a self-relating negativity because it's your profession and taking care of yourself and you're not encountering the other. What ends up happening, funny enough, in the country is you actually, by having less people, see more individuals that you then confront. And you're forced to acknowledge the need to band together because you're, say, in nature and it's not mechanicalized. You have to, literally, winter is a problem. Like, it can freeze the pipes out. Y'all have to work together. Where in the city, you may not even notice the seasons as much, right? And so the thing is, Dostoevsky, and then I'll give it back to you, he had this wonderful line at the beginning of The Brothers Karamazov where a guy's confessing to Zosima and he says, you know, Father Zosima, I came to love humanity and lost the ability to love individuals. And this was like a sin. And I think what the great challenge today in a very interconnected world is loving humanity while not loving individuals. Because funny enough, humanity is a kind of like so many individuals, it becomes nothing, but in a bad way, there's a kind of effacement. Whereas an individual you encounter, and the Good Samaritan must be an individual, not just a humanity. And you must then, when you encounter the challenge of the Good Samaritan, not deconstruct them, but figure out, no, how do I create a situation where we actually pour blessings into one another, which then we're just lost in the other person because the relationship works, as opposed to consciously thinking about it, and then it becomes pathological and relating on ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah, that really made me think a lot about when you spoke about masculinity as a gift. Then what I really got from that as well was like masculinity in action, as like, yes, as in concrete actions. Yes. You know, it's like that, just as love has to be an action as well.
Yes.
And our tendency to kind of theorize and to, you know, the love of humanity,
yes,
becomes this very abstract thing. Whereas I think Christian love is always expressed in the moment directly to another person. Because it's an act of self-sacrifice a lot of the time.
Yes.
And so there needs to be this kind of like concrete action of giving up in a very physical way. I there's something about masculinity, I think, which is physical and action. I don't really know. I don't have a theoretical background. Maybe you can try and put better words on that as well. But it's like, you know, I love the idea of masculinity as creation with our hands. You know, mm-hmm. Women, they create life with their bodies.
Sure.
We men, we create with our hands, and that's what we do. And you know, when you gave your list of like kind of like, or your questions of like how you could add value to a neighbor, I was thinking, oh, that's like a really good American small town idea, talking about different values. So it was great that you then said like, well, you know, how do we establish these values as well? But there is something really about that physicality to masculinity as well. I don't, what do you say about that?
I think that's fantastic, because I think a lot of the false masculinity or problematic masculinities are masculinities based on abstractions versus the hand. So for example, you're like, you know, I'm the CEO of a company and I'm better than other people. Or you're like, that's an abstraction, right? That's a position. But what do you actually do? Like, do you just get the praise while the workers do everything? You know, a lot of men, there's a mistake of defining masculinity in terms of like abstractions or abstract positions or what people think of you in a kind of prideful way, as opposed to the raw question of, no, can you actually, fix the well house? Can you actually, if you're naked in a room, have a conversation that actually adds wisdom? One of the videos an individual was talking about, and I really loved it, the kind of history of storytellers, where the men would be around the fire and they tell stories to the children. Can you do that? I do think thinking about in terms of, it's always weird to talk about being a writer, because what does that mean when you're not writing, right? It's almost really good to kind of realize that you're not a writer unless you're writing, unless you're doing the action. And so likewise, masculinity comes out in the flow of the ability to not break when you encounter a challenge, like the tree needs to be moved, or someone needs you there to help, or someone needs you to be there and be fully present. Are you able to do that? Well, that's all an action. And masculinity then is something that occurs, not something you define yourself by, but a way you carry yourself in the world. Now, obviously, of someone who does writing all the time can call themselves a writer, but language always has a danger in it, because you can start thinking about writer as a static identity, and you can be a writer without ever writing. You can just call yourself a writer, right? So likewise, you can call yourself a man without ever doing anything masculine. So that's the danger. But if you always remember it in the context of that action, which for me is the unarmored test, well, then it always is forced to the question of the hands, of the practice, of what you're doing.
Yeah. I thought that unarmored test was really interesting. It really made me think a lot about Jonathan Peugeot's ideas about the garments of skin.
I am not familiar. I always love hearing him. He was talking the other day. I listened to a video on phenomenology as primary, which is excellent, but I'm not familiar with that.
So yeah, he takes, and this is from the church fathers, I think especially Gregory of Nyssa, who speaks about the garments of skin, which Adam and Eve were given after the fall as a kind of precursor or archetypical form to understand our relation to technology. So the garments of skin were not positive or negative in a fundamental way, but they were a way of coping with the situation after the fall. But they entailed animals being killed to be able to provide skins that Adam and Eve could then cover themselves.
Right.
And this is a way of looking at technology, which I think is incredibly valuable and powerful and innovative as well, actually, to understand how we use technology to expand and ourselves, to protect ourselves and to increase our power in the world. But they also somehow, we're certainly a lot less naked, which means that we lose touch with ourselves. And so as men, we somehow love technology, right? Because it increases our expansion and our power, but also an excessive reliance on technology emancipates men. And you can see this in today's man compared to, 100 years ago, where every man could chop down a tree and fix a car and stuff like that. And, today we have men who, just look at testosterone levels have plummeted. And a lot of this, I think you can connect to our use of technology. And I specifically, I heard actually a Catholic priest called Rippenberger talking about use of technology and men. And he talks about especially, and this was a very valuable side, it's almost kind of formed a core principle. It's like, do not use technology as a man for pleasure only. It's very, very dangerous if you do that, because using technology is pleasurable. And if you start using technology for the purpose of pleasure, it becomes the self-referencing loop that you're going to get addicted to. And so this is, obviously pornography is the number one example of this, where you're actually just creating a love relationship with a screen and with that, where it becomes like your go-to thing every time you feel discomfort in your life or something like that. But I think they're, so using technology, I'm not against technology whatsoever, but I think this thing of being very, very aware of when you start using it for pleasure, then it becomes a dangerous thing. Technology is for work. And that's when we can use it as men, and we should do it with care as well, of being like addicted to its power creating effects somehow.
Well, one of the things you said that right there that's so important and
very well put is there has to be a standard by which to judge good technology use from bad technology use. Like you say, okay, am I using it for work or am I using it for autonomous pleasure, just pleasure? Mm-hmm. Well, the problem is you tend to end up in autonomous pleasure when you don't even think about your standard by which to judge your use. That's why for me, and then that will affect your practice, right? You'll say, okay, when am I using the laptop just to watch YouTube as opposed to do something productive, right? Well, now you have a standard to organize your practice. That's where the unarmored test was so useful for me, because then I had a test to organize my practice. Now, my grandfather used to do with the electric work, he would take a manual drill, pop it up and spin it himself. It just blows my mind. I use an electric drill. Should I go back to a world where I do that? No, I'm not going to, but I'm aware I'm losing something. I think that's the key. Like if you make the choice not to do that, you realize there's a trade-off. Now, maybe that trade-off is worth doing. Maybe you can get more work done with the tool, right? But even being aware of the trade-off goes a very, very long way. A lot of the problems tend to happen when we just absorb something without thinking about it, like secondhand smoke. Like we just absorb technology. We just absorb what other people are doing. Whereas I think it's very important in terms of masculinity, not to necessarily just get rid of all technology, but to think about the use. It actually would be easier if you just said, don't use any of it, because you could just push it aside. But to think about it requires that standard in inserting that standard. And the last thing I'll say is I think that reading of technology, the clothing as a kind of coping mechanism is very important. And that But the issue is when we immediately fell, we need the coping mechanism. And now there's this development of grace where we need to be moving to a place where we need the coping mechanism less, in the same, like you have to be like not needed as much because grace is developed. Your hearts are not as hard. You know, your hearts are not as hard as they were, like Jesus says. But we almost seem to be doing the exact opposite, you know, as opposed to trying to move to a place where we're less reliant and we're more conscious, we're actually becoming less aware. And it's like Ruperger talked about, it's okay to play video games as a kid, but there should naturally come a point where you don't do it anymore, right? There's a natural development that occurs. But what's happening is like the development is not there. And I think it's a result of a kind of thoughtless absorbing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there's a reading of kind of the entire fall as humanity's fall into self-consciousness or self-awareness.
Sure.
And I it's hard to really kind of, I'm still trying to grasp all the elements of that, I guess, but I do think that, you know, like we're going to continue to use more and more technology. And we normally, when we get new technologies, you know, the fall was a part of the plan. And the eating of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil was always intended, but we weren't ready for it yet. It was supposed to, you know, so therefore, and I think a good illustration of it is just like, you know, when we first got atomic technology, then one of the first things we did with it is we dropped atomic bombs on Japan, right? Mm-hmm. And now increasingly we're starting to use the subatomic technologies for productive and good uses. You know, when the internet first came out, I was the first kid in my school to have internet access back nice. In the 80s.
Wow.
And or maybe very early 90s, might have been 90, 91. What did I use it for? Well, you know, at nighttime, certainly when my parents had gone to bed, that I used it to look for pornography.
Sure.
And that was actually the main use of the internet in a lot of those early years. Actually, that was most of the traffic going through there was, and now increasingly we're saying, okay, well, yeah, the internet can become a very, very powerful and good tool, but it's certainly not always only for good as well. So I think we technology is something that can be used for the good, but we're often not mature enough to understand. We certainly don't understand the consequences of what it's going to be, but it doesn't mean we should go away from it. I think what you just said, like the intentional use of technology and knowing that you're making a trade-off for it. My wife really wanted to buy a log splitting machine to be able. We have a lot of firewood here. We have to cut down all the time, and I was like, no, I don't want to have a log splitting machine. I wouldn't be able to like do these things. Okay. I haven't done a lot of axe chopping in my life, but I feel that's for now it's a good thing as well. So yeah.
No, one of the most, I think, important notions that I ever heard is St. Augustine at some point basically says something like evil is a disordered good, because if it was created, it must be good. So therefore, evil must be a result of disorder. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I think that's very important is because like a lot of, you know, a lot of these things are a result not of being inherently bad, but because of a disordered relationship to it. Like when we talk about false masculinity, it's a disordered relationship to masculinity, right? And one of the ways to think about it is like it's a small shift, but even the thinking of like masculine versus female as opposed to masculine with female, and thus a more communal ontology framing, like obviously people can use those terms to be fine, but that little framing, same variables, masculine and feminine, but the relation moves from a kind of either or to a with. Well, the with transforms the order. And what I always think is profound is in Genesis, you mentioned, it's not Adam and Eve until after the fall. It's the man and woman both named Adam. There's a Trinitarian structure. You know, God's in the garden. There's the three and they share, you know, multiple persons, but a same essence as found in the name, because name signifies something deeper than just a signifier. And then it splits into Adam and Eve. So likewise, if we're trying to return to a kind of original intention, then, you know, masculine and feminine have to be thought of in terms of part of a same essence, right? And if you don't get that ordered, well, then you can end up with problematic forms of masculinity and femininity. And then what ends up happening is what I think is happening today is because there has been that disorder, which I think has been assisted by technology, because technology makes it easier to disorder things in all different areas. Well, then the response to that is very naturally, well, just get rid of it all, deconstruct it all. It's no good. But you see, that's where you're getting pulled into a deeper level. There's a sense in which you don't want to think about it because you're supposed to be at such an excess that it's self-forgetful, but deconstruction as an absence It's the loss of it that's going to create a pathological self-destruction, and it's in the terms of self-relation. And so that's where I think we are right now in the culture, to get to your first question, is we've had a disordered thinking about masculinity and femininity that has been assisted mostly, I would say, by like technology. Now, this is another topic, I'd have to defend all this, but we've had that disorder, and then there's been a response to that disorder, not of reform, but of deconstruction, not of reordering it rightly, but getting rid of it. And that just makes it worse.
Yeah, it's an attempt to negate things instead of trying to integrate. Okay, mm-hmm. Well, Daniel, let's finish off with one last question.
Yes.
This might need to be the topic for a whole next video, but let's see what we can do on here. Because when I was listening to you talking about masculinity and the good neighbor, I was thinking, well, a lot of this is just as applicable for men as it is for women.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. And yet we talk about masculinity in this specific context. And I think that a lot of these aspects are specifically applicable for masculinity. So, yeah, why is this conversation different for it? For example, if we'd be talking about femininity, would you say, and in what way, how do we distinguish between those two conversations?
No, this is a profound question, because there is seemingly
the optimal state for the female. Now, one, I'm talking about masculinity because I am a male, and this is my experience of masculinity and how I came to terms with masculinity, so that it wasn't a burden that caused anxiety, but was just like an act that you would do as you encounter challenging situations. So, you know, that's from my own story. If I were to posit, based on the Garden of Eden, it does seem as if feminine forgetfulness is the optimal state as well, where you're so feminine that you don't think of your naked. You don't think, you just are feminine, right? I think there are differences, though, in what it would mean for the male to pass the unarmored test versus the female on the unarmored test. And the reason is because when I go to the neighbor's house, there are indeed expectations of you should be able to cut down the tree. Whereas with the woman, it might be you should be able to listen to someone's situation and help them process their emotion, right? That's not every man. That's not every woman. But it tends to be when you encounter the neighbor, there are different notions of which you are going to be presented with as able to flow with as opposed to break, and thus cause self-relating negativity that transforms what it means to, as a male, add value to the neighbor, or as a female to add value. Now, our culture today is kind of saying, well, those expectations shouldn't be there. You should be able to go and there shouldn't be those expectations. And that's an entirely different discussion. I think it gets into the question of where the expectations come from. Are they top down? Are they emergent? Do you see cultures all on their own creating different notions of the kind of things a male should be able to do than a female? Is it a result of a power class, or is it a result of people in their own common life coming to feel as if these are the things? So you get into all of that. But I think there is a difference, because what it means for a male to add value to their neighbor and to meet the challenge of their neighbor is different than what a female is. But yes, that would kind of open the door. And then I do think that the question of the unarmored test is actually extremely useful for spouses to think about. Are you hiding from your wife on your phone? Have you taken the time to understand how she sees the world, so that you actually hear her and see the world through her terms, as opposed to what you think her terms are? And the same goes with friends and different things.
Yeah, and I definitely think there's something we could dive into that more in a subsequent conversation. I'll just add that, you know, so living in Denmark, which is one of the countries in the world that's probably done the most to try and get rid of all of the norms of gender expectations, sure. Then it's been fascinating coming to a small city and seeing how things are here. My neighbor actually is a couple where she is a bricklayer. So it's a very traditionally masculine job. But they are probably the most, in their personalities and their way of being together, the most traditional masculine, feminine sure. couple in the whole town almost. And they're very explicit about it, about how they reject all these ideas that, you know, they should be anything different than that. She looks very masculine. She, you know, has a very masculine job, but certainly in their way of being together, it's very, very important for them that he is the man in the relationship and she's the woman in the relationship. And so I think the idea that we should just, you know, these things are just systems of oppression, we need to get rid of them. It's an idea that's not going to last or stand up to any kind of real scrutiny and testing in real lives of people with after functioning relationships. But, you know, in some places it seems to be able to thrive, I guess, as well.
Well, I'll just add, I think the value of the modern critique of, say, gender roles is when we start saying a man is someone who bricklays, as if a woman cannot bricklay. Mm-hmm. Well, there you're actually defining the gender roles in accordance to armors, right? Like jobs, you see, and that actually is a problem. I know lots of women. I know lots of women who can fix electrical work, who work harder than men, frankly, who are more capable of those things. And so the problem, which is the value, because in some respects, the current critiques of masculinity can of itself be viewed as a good Samaritan. One has to see as a challenge. There's actually some value in the critique because we have problematically tended to escape facing ourselves unarmored by identifying gender in terms of armor, which there are many things women can do just as well as men. And also the other thing is why I think there is a difference in this topic is because I don't, like Adriana does such extraordinary work on the menstrual cycles and and how that affects women's life. I don't have to deal with that, right? So that creates a different lived experience and what it means to carry myself as a person for other people, as opposed to women who know those experiences and can be there for other people in different ways. So there are those differences. What we need to do, though, is think about it in terms of, like I said, it helps me to think of it in terms of the unarmored, as opposed to trying to identify gender in terms of different armors. That's where I think we get a lot of problems.
Daniel, that's fascinating, valuable, and really useful, and really great conversation. I'm going to have to run now. So really appreciate the time and for putting together that conversation. If anybody enjoyed this short conversation and didn't get to see Daniel's presentation, then I highly recommend going and watching that. That gives a really good foundational viewpoint on it. Please let us know if you have comments or thoughts. Anything else you'd like to be hearing about, hit the subscribe button, of course, on the channel, and go check out OG Rose, a partnership between Daniel and his wife, where they go through a whole lot of different philosophical ideas and thoughts about life and existence from a great perspective. So thanks, Daniel.
Thank you, Paul. I've enjoyed it, Mr. Robson. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Conversations on Masculinity with Manifesto. We enjoy good discussions, but far more importantly, we are a real community with plenty of opportunities for you to engage online and in person. So check out our website on manifesto.com to learn more. And if you enjoyed the content here, then please share this podcast with a friend. Thanks.